I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Flashing a victory sign, an Iranian scientist who claims he was abducted and tortured by U.S. agents returned to Tehran today to a hero's welcome. Was he abducted by the CIA as he claimed, or is he a defector, someone willingly working with the CIA for over a year? And the Washington Post adds a new twist today, reporting that U.S. officials say they paid Shahram Amri more than $5 million to provide intelligence on Iran's controversial nuclear program. Greg Miller is national security reporter for the Post. And Greg, Amri first surfaced in the Pakistan embassy this week with his claims of abduction. Is it unusual that CIA officials, even anonymously, are now saying they actually paid him?
Yes, it's highly unusual. I think in some ways it serves their interests to acknowledge that he was paid, because it undermines his assertions that he was brought here against his will and tortured and abducted.
Yeah. Well, officials are telling you these payments came from a program the CIA calls the Brain Drain. This is their attempt to lure scientists from places like Iran and North Korea. And one U.S. official told you they basically set him up with a long-term benefits package. But did he actually get that money?
The way it appears to work is that the agency makes this payment, and in this case it was more than $5 million, puts it into accounts that are controlled by this individual. But they also try to set it up in such a way that it can sustain this person over a lifetime in the United States after being relocated here. So he may have gotten the money, may have had control of the money, but may not have used the money, and it may now be in accounts that he can't access.
Well, the BBC's John Line told us earlier this week that Amiri may have been worried about his family back in Iran. He's being pictured now with his 7-year-old son, who burst into tears when dad came home. Doesn't that raise questions about why the CIA, if in fact this was a defector, why they would invest so much in someone who did have family back in his home country?
Well, this happens all the time, and there's a long history of this in espionage. If you get the defector out, can you get his family out? Because if you can't, that is a source of often severe pressure on that individual, either wanting to return home simply because he's homesick and misses his family, or because he fears for their safety and what might happen to them at the hands of the government that he betrayed.
And do we know, Greg, any more about, A, what's absolutely true in this case, defector or a kidnapped victim? And do we know any more about what, if he was a defector, he did tell the U.S.?
We know that he apparently provided some useful intelligence for the United States. I mean, I've had multiple officials tell me that this was not somebody who was in the upper echelon of Iran's nuclear program, not privy to the decision makers at the very top of that decision chain. But nonetheless, he's a scientist who had extensive access to a number of facilities and was able to provide a lot of information, confirming sometimes details from other sources and in some cases adding new information that they had not known before. In terms of how he was treated and how he came here, what we have are his accounts and the accounts of multiple U.S. officials that are entirely at odds. I mean, the U.S. officials often point out that if this is somebody who was brought against his will, held in confinement, mistreated in some way, how is it that he was able to make videos, web videos that were then broadcast back in Iran? How is it he was able to get himself to the Iran mission in Washington, D.C. to go home?
Yeah. Well, you write that the CIA's payments to Amiri add to what has become one of the most bizarre recent episodes in espionage. And I'm thinking that's a long list right now, what with the alleged Russian spy ring.
We had a return to the Cold War this month. We have the strange denouement of this espionage case involving Iran, which is one of the primary adversaries, one of the hardest targets for U.S. intelligence. And the way all of this has played out so publicly is what is so unusual.
You know, Greg Miller, one last question. Amiri was greeted by state officials, as we said, a hero's welcome. But it's hard to imagine that that can continue if, in fact, they suspect that he did give information to the U.S.
Well, that's an odd thing. You're right. I mean, here's a guy who the U.S. asserts has provided extensive information on some of Iran's most secret nuclear programs and is now being championed back home. A large reason for that is just propaganda. It's just to say, here's somebody who escaped the clutches of the United States and the CIA, and to give him that hero's welcome. But I'm sure that he will have a different life back in Iran than the one he left when he disappeared from Saudi Arabia more than a year ago.
Greg Miller, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
BP says it's fixed the recent leak in the giant cap that was going to plug the gushing well, but it will take at least 48 hours of testing to tell whether or not the cap can withstand the pressure of that oil. Meanwhile, that oil continues to pour into the Gulf and wash up on beaches. As we reported last week, all of this tar-coated sand that's being scooped up is getting dumped into local landfills. Well, in Harrison County, Mississippi alone, 150 tons of this mess has been dumped in their landfill. The contractor, Waste Management, says the waste is non-hazardous. But Connie Rocco, a Republican County supervisor in Harrison County, has questions. And she joins us from WJZD Radio in Gulfport, Mississippi. Supervisor Rocco, Connie, why are you against this?
We did not dump millions of tons of oil into our Mississippi Gulf Coast, and it should not be our responsibility to keep it here for eternity. We have valuable landfill space that is used for municipal waste and should be used for us in the future so that we do not have to expand a landfill and put that burden on the people that live around that landfill and the people that are here.
We understand that county officials are going to conduct their own tests on some of the product that's washing up on the beach because, what, you have questions about whether or not it is appropriate for your landfills?
Absolutely. We need to find out if it is toxic. We want to know all the chemicals that are in that landfill. Oil is not good for the landfill. If it goes into the leachate collection, it has to be carried off and put into a wastewater treatment plant.
You mentioned this leachate collection or leachate lining. What is that?
Leachate is merely the liquid that goes through the garbage, and the water from the garbage, they roll over it time after time, and they have these big machines, and they squeeze and compact the garbage. And when it rains, of course, water gets into the garbage. And when that water reaches the leachate collection system, it's pumped out and taken to a wastewater treatment plant, unless it has oil in it. And the wastewater treatment center can turn it away if it does not pass their muster.
Well, it would seem that that's going to have to happen, that, all of this tons of debris that's coming off the beach, these tar balls, they're going to have oil in them.
Absolutely. And the dispersant. The dispersant we worry more about than the oil. We also passed a resolution that they stop using it because they don't use it in Europe.
Well, so here we are. We have something of a standoff. A Waste Management, they have a permit. It's a 5-year permit to use your town landfills. And they say they've tested the material that they're dumping there from the oil blowout, and they say that it's not hazardous. You are going to test it as a county because you have questions. But then what do you do? What if you do find out it's hazardous?
Well, we will probably go to court with not only Waste Management but BP as well. It's very disheartening when you know that there are alternatives there. There's pyrolytics, which is a new technology that heats up the waste, turns it into small, small, tiny little particles, and turns that waste into energy. We also looked at a machine that actually cleans the sand and separates the oil from the sand and recycles the oil, sends it to a refinery. So we have those two technologies that we have looked for. We've even sent those to Waste Management. In one case, I know the pyrolytic technology we have. So that being said, why won't they be the heroes? BP could step up to the plate, and instead of leaving a lifetime of trash, hazardous material, I'll call it, in our landfill, they could leave us a technology that would help us for the next 20 years as we pick up tar balls off of our beach. They spent $50 million on booms that did not work. And then they're going to balk at looking at new technology that does work to keep things out of a landfill. When they've dumped on us in the front yard, they're going to dump on us in the backyard as well.
But as we stand now, you've got this 150 tons of debris in a landfill. What happens if you do win? It's already there.
Well, it's in a particular cell, so we know exactly where it is, and it can be extracted.
In the meantime, what else do you think should be happening in your area in regards to the debris that's washing up on the beaches? What should BP be doing? What should the government be involved?
BP and the federal government have been so slow to act on anything that we have brought to them. Our staff and supervisors, which were county commissioners, have looked at berms. We've looked at sand rakes. We've looked at every type of technology that you can imagine that has come to the Gulf Coast to try and protect ourselves. We take it to BP. Now, doesn't that seem strange that they, a multi-billion dollar business, wouldn't have all of these tools and looked at them and tested them, all of this, all these weapons in their arsenal to defend something like this? It baffles the mind.
Well, Connie, I just have to ask you, though, as we said, you're the Republican county supervisor there in Harrison County, Mississippi. You've got a Republican governor, Haley Barbour. You just were critical of the federal government's response, but Haley Barbour was the one early on saying that there was no problem. He was angry about how much of a fuss was being made about the blowout. He said it was stopping tourism.
I can't speak for Haley Barbour, but, you know, just because you're Republicans don't mean you agree with every single Republican that's in office. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Well, Connie Rocco, quick question. How about the Democratic president, President Obama's moratorium on deep-sea drilling? He's relaxed it somewhat, saying he will allow some drilling if the rigs can prove that they have a means to shut down if there's a problem. But I know you don't think a blanket moratorium is a good idea. What would you suggest?
I would suggest that you don't close down the whole industry, but you go in and examine. Do them three at a time or one at a time and have experts go in and examine them, look at them, and make sure that everything is safe. And when you put a moratorium on oil, you have to think of all the people you're putting out of work.
Connie Rocco again, county supervisor in Harrison County, Mississippi. Just tell us, you know, what do your beaches look like?
Well, they are being cleaned constantly, and the tar balls that we get are, and sometimes tar mats, as we had some as big as school buses last week.
Wow.
They're cleaned up. We have a 3-foot berm that separates the beach from the water, and people are still allowed to go to the beach. And as of yet, our seafood in this area has not been affected. Even though our fishing waters have been closed. We're at the mercy of the tide as to what happens with the tar balls and the tar that reaches our beaches. And we hope that Waste Management and BP will step up to the plate and look at alternatives. And if not, we will just, I guess they'll continue to put the oil into the landfill until it's settled in court, and then they'll have to extract it.
Connie Rocco, County Supervisor in Harrison County, Mississippi. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Supervisor Rocco. Just best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, to see a slideshow of workers cleaning up the waste on Harrison County beaches, go to herenow.org. And another note, we called BP several times to get their reaction to the county's concerns. They didn't get back to us. And as Connie Rocco said, there is new technology to clean sand and recycle waste into usable crude oil. We're going to speak with a company that claims they can do this. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about what happens to the hundreds of tons of tar-covered sand that BP crews are scooping off Gulf Coast beaches. Right now, most of it's going into local landfills, but several contractors say they have new technology that cleans the sand and recycles the tar back into crude oil. Steve Dowdy works for Trimon Incorporated. That's a U.S. distributor for Roland Environmental Services, and that's a Canadian company that they say they have a machine that's been used for similar work in Canada. Steve joins us from his office in Oklahoma City. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we remind ourselves, we've done stories on this. Canada has these vast amounts of oil sand reserves. So rather than drilling for oil using wells, they have a process where they extract oil from the sands. It's both considered an alternative, but it's also controversial because it creates more greenhouse gases than drilling. But putting that aside, your company and the Canadian counterpart, you go in after the extraction is done and clean up. How do you want to apply that technology to what's happened in the Gulf?
Well, we have a proprietary and patented process where we can strip the oil from the sand. So if we had a fixed facility site that would allow us to take the sand, to mine the sand along the beaches, take it to our facility, we have a way of separating that oil from the sand through mechanical agitation, simple chemistry, and heat.
Is any of that chemistry toxic? Because that's been the problem all along.
These are chemicals. There are one chemical that is used every day in household items. It's not toxic to the environment. In fact, what we've been doing is shuttling samples of the worst-case scenario sands of the beach back to our test facilities here in Oklahoma, and we've started with as much as 108,000 parts per million. That's about 10% oil saturation of the sand, and we've taken it down to non-detectable limit.
Okay, so take the sand first. What happens to the sand after your process, and how does it look?
Well, sand is extremely clean, and we've provided demonstrations of that process to county and state officials down along the Gulf Coast. It becomes, once again, the pristine sand that made up the Gulf Coast.
And what happens?
Everybody likes.
And what happens to the tar?
Well, the tar turns into a fluid hydrocarbon system where we skim off the water, and then we reuse. We can reuse that oil or have another use of the oil to where it can be used as heating oil or go right into the pipeline.
By the way, we know that one of the controversies is that the county wants that oil. It's on their beaches now, and they want to be able to sell it, as you said, for further use. But who owns the oil?
That has yet to be determined, Robin. I think it's going to be in the courts for a while to determine just if the federal government owns it, the state governments, or BP themselves.
Yeah. Well, and how long, if you were allowed to go ahead, how long do you think it'll take to clean it up?
This is going to be a process of years. This is not going to be a quick fix. We've got miles and miles of beachfront that have been affected, and we've still got a lot of oil offshore. If we get a large hurricane that pushes more of the mass onto the beach, we're going to be dealing with this for a long, long time.
But you say years, 5 years, 10 years?
I'd say at least 5 years. Remember that the Valdez oil spill, we've recovered less than 10% of the total volume of the Valdez at this point, some 18 years later.
You've applied to BP. What's the delay here? Why are you not talking to them?
Well, we are. We're just waiting for a call. Our equipment is ready to go to work on the moment's notice. Keep in mind that the last time I checked, there were 4,700 contractors that had signed up with fixes to propose to BP that why they can help the Gulf Shore incident.
Well, so it may be just a matter of a backup, but meanwhile, this sand with tar in it is going to local landfills. Waste Management, the company that is licensed to take care of waste, says that they've tested it. It's perfectly fine. Now, Waste Management is your competitor right now for business from BP and cleaning up the beaches. But I'll ask you anyway, what do you think about taking that stuff to a landfill?
Well, it's true that you can plane up all this sand and take it to a landfill probably faster than what we can process it. But when that landfill is filled to the brim, then you've got to go out and try to permit another site. These are very expensive to build, and they have to be site suitability study has to be done. You can't just put a landfill just anywhere these days.
We should say some of what you find might still go to the landfill. For instance, there might be oil-coated trash on the beach, and you're only extracting the oil from sand, so there will still be some trash if you were to do the cleanup process. But if BP gives the green light, do you have a regulatory green light?
What we're doing right now, I'm part of a regulatory team that is going into the individual states, talking to the regulators so that we can prepare ourselves for moving down to the Gulf Coast.
Meanwhile, if you get to do this, we're assuming you're not talking about taking a dump truck at a time. What will the beaches look like if you, let's say, go to a couple-mile-long beach to begin this process and take the sand away to a facility to clean it?
Well, we will be assigned a certain area to clean up. Of course, that will be cordoned off to limit access to that area. We can process anywhere from 700 to 1,000 cubic yards per 24 hours per unit. So if we had multiple units, we could process more material. But as we process it, we'll put it back.
Translate that. Will there be like a half a mile of beach trucked away? Will there be big tubes sucking it out? What does it look like?
It'll essentially be a mining operation where we have front-end loaders that will take the sand and offload it into trucks to be taken to that centralized facility maybe a mile away, mm-hmm. and then cleaned up and then trucked back to that site.
Yeah.
We also have plans for a mobile facility to where we can access parts of the beach.
Stephen Doughty, he works for Trimon Incorporated, a U.S. distributor for a Canadian company. What they do is separate oil from sand, recycle both, and he's just waiting for a green light from BP. Stephen Doughty, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
We're looking this week at how Democrats and Republicans are preparing for fall midterm elections. Yesterday, we heard how Massachusetts Republican Senator Scott Brown is infuriating some in his base by supporting the financial reform bill. Well, today we'll hear how key Democrats are going against the grain on gun control, embracing gun owners' rights and currying favor with the NRA, a lobby that's, of course, long been a darling of Republicans. Susan Milligan reported the story for the Boston Globe. Susan, just give us some of the big Democratic names.
Well, Paul Hodes running for Senate in New Hampshire, Jack Conway running for Senate in Kentucky, Harry Reid, the majority leader, trying to hang on to his seat in Nevada. There's talk he might actually get the NRA endorsement. Kirsten Gillibrand in New York State has been a friend of gun owners up there. She's an upstate New Yorker. Brad Ellsworth in Indiana, that's a big one because the NRA has put out flyers against his Republican opponent, Dan Coats.
Yeah, tell us a little more about that because that is stunning. He got Brad Ellsworth, the Democrat, got an A rating from the NRA, but as you said, they've called his opponent weak on guns.
Yes, I believe it's because of Mr. Coates' support for the ban on assault weapons going way back, and they didn't like that, so they were in the primary putting out flyers against Mr. Coates. I mean, what this really does for Democrats is just inoculate them a little bit, particularly in some states and some districts where gun ownership is important to people.
Well, let's put this in some context, Susan, because Democrats may have to do a little more work than normal on this issue because of what happened after President Obama was elected. This whole issue was ginned up. It was said that he was going to take away gun rights, and gun sales went through the roof. You talked to a gun store owner.
Yes, there's an interesting thing going on here because I think there was a perception out there that President Obama was going to have a big gun control agenda. In fact, that's not been the case at all. And in fact, he's been a big disappointment, for example, to the Brady campaign against gun violence because all he's pretty much done so far is to sign a law that included as part of it something that allows people to bring guns into federal parks. So there's no hard evidence for people to be nervous that he'll take their guns away. What I found in reporting the story, however, is that the gun rights issue is actually kind of a proxy issue for a much bigger, more amorphous worry out there that government is taking over people's lives. I actually saw inside this gun store in Hooksett, New Hampshire, some posters kind of against the health care bill, you know, whether it's the health care bill or even some other regulatory reforms or just a sense people have that government is encroaching on their lives. And so the gun they see is something that represents their power against government, maybe not literally, but certainly figuratively. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the gun issue remains pretty potent for people.
And why you see Democrats like Senator Reid getting a provision in the health care bill that bans insurance companies from charging higher premiums on people with guns in their home. This is something, a provision the NRA really wanted. So Democrats, really working hard to offset whatever those perceptions are.
Yes, absolutely. And you can see it even in their platform language going back to 2000. In 2000, the Democratic National Committee platform was proud of the work that they had done for an assault weapons ban and for the Brady Bill. And then after that, the language got softer. And in the 2008 platform, they make a point of saying that they believe in Second Amendment rights and they talk about responsible gun ownership and reasonable gun restrictions. They're clearly trying to sort of cater to that part of the country. Now, it's important to note, too, that in 2006, one of the reasons that the Democrats picked up seats out in rural areas and in the Mountain West is because they attracted candidates who were pro-gun, because that's the way their districts are. And Brad Ellsworth is a perfect example of that. He's an
Indiana
congressman,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's a pro-gun guy, and running for Senate in that state, which is going to be very, very hard for Democrats. that really helps them and gives them a little bit of a chance.
Whereas Democratic candidates in places like Chicago or here in Boston, where there's so much concern about guns in the urban areas, may not take that same tack.
That's exactly right. And this issue is pretty much over. The gun rights people have really won. They've won a couple of big Supreme Court cases. The Democrats have really retreated on this as an issue. You don't even hear people really talking about it on the floor that much. They've just stayed away from it. It's a very divisive issue. It's a cultural issue, and it does not help the Democrats to take it on, particularly this year.
Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Be back with a look at how police in Arizona are training to enforce that state's new immigration law in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. A federal judge will hear arguments today as to whether Arizona's controversial immigration law should even take effect as scheduled later this month. The Justice Department is suing to stop the law because it requires local governments rather than federal officials to enforce immigration law. And Arizona is starting to train local police. Now, under the new law, they are required to ask about the immigration status of a suspect they encounter while carrying out routine police work. Now, as we've reported here, jurisdictions in about 26 states train police in carrying out immigration law, but it's under the federal program known as 287G that's run by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE. Arizona's is the first state-run program, and today we get a closer look at the training, beginning with a new training tape.
The entire country is watching to see how Arizona, in particular Arizona law enforcement, responds. Regardless of your personal opinions about the immigration debate, your response as an individual officer is going to have significant impact on the direction of that debate. Can local law enforcement be trusted with such powers?
That's Lyle Mann. He's executive director of Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training, the state agency that will train police. He joins us on the line from his office in Phoenix. Lyle, welcome.
Welcome, Robin. How are you today?
I'm fine. And, you know, I mentioned this federal 287G program. Arizona has it in the Department of Corrections, several counties, cities like Mesa. We understand you borrowed some aspects of that federal program, but that's a far more in-depth training on full immigration law. And we understand as well that the 287G program, the federal program, is much more jail-based. It's enacted when a police bring a suspect into jail and then a trained officer takes over from there. Whereas Arizona, well, it's much more street-based. You're sending local cops out on the street to enact law.
You're correct. What they're trained to do is identify the reasonable suspicion factors and then contact this much higher trained person, if you will, the 287G or the ICE person.
Right.
So our training is simply to, in some ways, to raise the red flags. And then who are the resources you can go to if you have found those red flags?
Well, the tape very carefully instructs when police can even interact with someone. Let's listen.
The law applies when an officer has made a lawful stop, detention, or arrest for a violation of law.
So, Lyle, civil rights groups are afraid that, first of all, people who are anti-illegal immigrant are going to report people that they think are illegal immigrants. We already see a list being published in Utah of people suspected of being illegal immigrants. What are you telling police about when they can come into contact with someone?
What we're telling police is what their responsibilities are when they have stopped, detained, or arrested someone. This law does not deal with the reporting of suspicious people, the reporting of somebody who thinks somebody else is illegal. That's not what this law is about. Yeah. This law is about what an officer does when they arrest or stop someone on a separate crime.
Okay, so that's part one. Part two, if they have stopped someone on a separate crime, and they have reasonable suspicion that these are illegal immigrants, they can ask about status. Now, how do you define reasonable suspicion?
Reasonable suspicion is a totality of circumstances based on all the factors that the officer has in front of them.
Well, as you well know, this is the sticky part for a lot of people because what's suspicious to one person may not be to another. The training video lists many circumstances, topping the list, not having an ID, being in a place where illegal immigrants congregate looking for work, maybe the person has trouble speaking English, and then here are a few more.
Vehicle is overcrowded or rides heavily. Passengers in vehicle attempt to hide or avoid detection. dress. Demeanor, for example, unusual or unexplained nervousness, erratic behavior, refusal to make eye contact.
Now, Lyle, as you well know, Latino advocates have been saying, well, of course people are going to be nervous if they're pulled over by police. And then there's dress. What would somebody see in the way someone's dressed that would make them suspicious?
One way that an officer might see something, and remember, every one of those has a reasonable explanation. Every one of those taken in totality could, based on the officer's experience in the situation, lead to reasonable suspicion. So to separate them out is not what we tell the officers. It is to look at all of them. Now, going back to dress, what if the person had multiple layers of clothing on where the weather didn't suggest that?
If it's 110 degrees, which it always is, yeah.
So it would indicate to the officer that potentially this person is trying to transport his clothes with him rather than put them in a bag or some of those kinds of things, because that's what we, based on experience, know the individuals walking through the desert do.
Some other things that are on the tape that the police can use include a foreign vehicle registration, being in the company of other illegal aliens, prior information about the person. Does that mean that somebody whispered in the cop's ear, I think this person might be illegal?
One of the realities of enforcement in Arizona is not everyone who is stopped and identified as an alien and here illegally is turned over to Border Patrol. So there may be information in a police department database that says this individual was stopped and a contact was made with Border Patrol. And that piece of information would clearly be an important piece for the current officer to make a decision.
The tape seems to go out of its way to respond to concerns that this is going to turn into racial profiling. Just what are some of the things you're telling police?
Robin, we knew that this was going to be a huge issue. And so in the training, we wanted to make it very, very clear to officers that race was not a factor in their decision-making in terms of reasonable suspicion. And certainly, race is not an indicia of criminality.
Well, and you say the question I always ask is, would you come to the same conclusion about suspects if they're not minorities? But are you really expecting police, when they do that list, when they say, geez, there seem to be too many people in this car, and the driver doesn't know the people in the car, and they all have 10 layers of clothing on, and they're all Hispanic. You really don't think they're going to put that on their list?
Frankly, given the hypothetical that you just stated, the officer probably is going to have come to his reasonable suspicion well before he gets to ethnicity at all. When you were saying it, I'm going, okay, I'm calling now. I mean, it doesn't matter what they are.
In other words, you're saying the list shouldn't start with they're Hispanic.
No, yeah, okay. That's right.
Lyle Mann, Executive Director of Arizona Post, the agency that is training police to enact the new law, which is scheduled to go into effect later this month. Lyle, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
And some police chiefs in Arizona are against the new law. Lyle tells us he's aware that enforcing it could lead to unintended consequences, such as damaging relationships police have built up in minority communities. We go into the break with a bit more from that training tape from the head of the Arizona Police Association.
Without a doubt, we are going to be accused of racial profiling no matter what we do on this. The best thing that we can do is to document thoroughly where we develop our reasonable suspicion, our probable cause, then I think you're on firm ground.
Back in 1 minute, here and now. Journalist Gerald Boyd broke barriers. The first black journalist of the year at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the first black White House correspondent at the New York Times, also the first black Metro editor, the first black managing editor, the second editorial position at the Times. He edited the paper's Pulitzer Prize-winning series on race, and in March of 2002, under his orchestration as managing editor, the Times won a record 7 Pulitzers, mostly for the paper's coverage of 9/11. Gerald Boyd had reached a rare pinnacle. But then, like a climber tethered to a less experienced climber, Gerald Boyd was pulled tumbling down by Jason Blair, who took a spectacular fall from grace after fabricating and plagiarizing New York Times stories. It was said that Gerald Boyd was Jason's mentor, that Boyd overlooked Blair's flaws because they were both black. Gerald Boyd claimed he hardly knew Jason Blair, but he and executive editor Howell Raines were asked to leave the paper in June of 2003. Gerald Boyd died of cancer in November of 2006, but his memoir of his career as a journalist and his take on the Jason Blair scandal has been posthumously published in My Times in Black and White, Race and Power at the New York Times. His widow, journalist Robin Stone, joins us from the Argo Network studios in New York to talk about all of this. Robin, welcome. And of course, you know, this is still very recent, our sympathy.
Thank you so much, Robin. I'm delighted to be here to talk about Gerald's story, which is truly a remarkable story. I call it a success story, actually.
Well, and what a trajectory. His mother died. His alcoholic father left him. His incredible grandmother raised him. And he was a paper boy for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch before they, you know, plucked him out, educated him, and hired him. Tell us more about the trajectory.
When you think about where he came from, born and reared in St. Louis, so poor that they didn't have money for lunch. They had breakfast and dinner. But he had a dream, and he got that dream when he was doing the Upward Bound program, where he got his first taste of journalism. And he decided as a junior in high school that he wanted to be a journalist and he wanted to be good enough to work at the New York Times. And he got himself a scholarship offered by the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis, his hometown newspaper, and he attended University of Missouri. And there he was a first as well. He was elected to the executive board of the student government. He was the first African American. So he was breaking ground even in college. And that's really where he started his journalism career. The scholarship came with a job at the Post-Dispatch. And that really, you know, opened the door. He was he found that doors were opening, you know, to him because he was African American, but also because he was talented. And once he got through the doors, and this was not just through school, but in every position he attained, he, you know, ran harder and pushed harder and ran faster than everybody else.
Well, and as he was rising, you know, the attendant slights that come with being first. He tells of some of them in the book, being interviewed for a reporting position, turning in the pieces he'd written, and being asked if he'd written them himself.
Well, absolutely. That was his introduction to the Times. And when he was offered a job at the Times by one of the editors, they said, well, you know, you could cover the South as a black man. So this is a great opportunity for you. And he was, you know, covering the White House. And he thought, well, I don't want to cover the South as a black man. I want to cover what I cover as a journalist. So, you know, he saw himself first and foremost as a journalist, as a Timesman, but mostly as a human being.
Yeah. Well, to the accusation of being Jason Blair's mentor, you kind of wonder what would be wrong with a black man helping a younger black man make it into an organization that was starving for diversity.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, Gerald was a mentor to many journalists in the profession. There are folks who are African-American, Hispanic, you know, white. There are women who all can point to Gerald Boyd as a mentor. He didn't mentor every person who was African-American. Some people saw him as a quote-unquote Uncle Tom because he didn't, you know, bring everybody along, though he certainly brought lots of folks along. But in Jason's case, he was not his mentor, but the assumption was solely because they were both African-American that he was, and that's not so bad, but that he looked the other way and he helped Jason when that was not the case. Gerald didn't hire Jason. He didn't supervise him, nor did he mentor him. You know, even Jason himself had said that he didn't even like Gerald. So, you know, the link was made because they were African American, and that was one of the more heartbreaking aspects of the whole scandal, if you will. That, you know, Gerald was at the Times for 20 years. He was a journalist for 30 years by then. He was a known quantity, and for all of that history to be tossed aside based on a assumption was deeply, deeply distressing.
Well, your husband told a meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists, and this is just a while after he left the Times, that as soon as a controversy arises concerning an African-American reporter, the senior African-American is automatically viewed as suspect. But your husband also told that National Association of Black Journalists gathering that he does share some blame for Jason Blair. And just to remind people, so incredibly plagiarizing and fantasizing in his writing that he did see some flaws along the way, that there were some alarms. What were they? What does he feel that he could have done?
Well, he writes about that in the book. You know, he shares that when Jason moved from one department to another, he could have shared with the editor of the new department that, you know, there were concerns about Jason's work history and his habits, and he didn't. And he notes that as the mistake that he made, but he certainly did not coddle this young man.
After the Jason Blair scandal, he's faced with cancer. He did not recover from the cancer. Did he ever recover from what happened at the Times?
I think he was on his way. You know, it was unfortunate. I mean, of course, the loss, but the timing that he could not sort of gain traction. He very much wanted to get back into a newsroom. He wanted to lead a newsroom. That was in his blood. And unfortunately, the right offer never came along. And I think a part of that had to do with the fact that he was, as you said, tethered to Jason Blair by, you know, assumptions based on race.
And you had together at the time that he left the Times a six-year-old. And we read of this astonishing scene where you have to break it to the six-year-old that his father's leaving the New York Times. Did this six-year-old Zachary really say, but it's not just a paper, it's a public trust?
Oh, yeah. Zachary, he understood that the Times was more than just a newspaper. Even at six, he had a sense that this was a big, big deal. And Zachary came to know the Times. He's, you know, he went there. He worked on the computers. Gerald had an ID made up for him. So, you know, Zachary, you know, and he was very much his dad's son. Zachary just graduated from the eighth grade. Mm. He read a poem at the graduation ceremony, and I just know Gerald would have been beaming that his son was reading a poem.
What was it about?
It was a poem that his principal asked him to write, and it's called No More Days Left to Go.
Oh, wow.
So it was very touching. But, you know, Zach and I are making our way.
That's journalist Robin Stone. We've been talking about her late husband Gerald Boyd's book, My Times in Black and White, Race and Power at the New York Times. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Robin.